Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Centers for Disease Control now estimate that one in every 68 children has been identified with an autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. As the name suggests, ASD diagnoses range in type and severity. Almost all, however, present social and sensory challenges. A person with autism spectrum disorder might struggle to read facial expressions or become overwhelmed in a restaurant or movie theater, and that could leave anyone feeling isolated and alone. The group Aspirations was established to give social and vocational support for people with autism at Ohio State University. Jeff Siegel is a coordinator of Aspirations. He joins us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So people with autism spectrum disorder can seem like loners, like they don't want company or friends, but this isn't really the case.
No. And the interesting thing about it is quite often what I hear from people is, well, I met somebody and I said hi to them and they didn't seem to really respond. They just sort of sat there or they didn't say anything. And so I figured they weren't friendly. And my retort to them is, well, you know, did you ever think about it? What might be going through their mind is about 1,000 miles a minute is, oh, what if I said this to this person and they said this? Or if I looked a funny way, what would they think? And an individual on the spectrum has really a lot of problems and does struggle a tremendous amount with figuring out what to say in a simple conversation of hello, hi, and just be able to carry on from there. They could carry on a conversation with you about the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand and everything about Archduke Ferdinand that they ever knew or that you'd ever want to know. But just simply saying hello could be extremely anxious for them. And they might just sit there totally frozen.
Are they self-conscious or are they clueless about it? And I don't mean to be sound glib either.
I think it's a mixture.
Okay.
Some people are clueless. Most people really do realize that there's something that they're missing. They're missing out on the social cues or something that everyone else gets. This is often when I interview people for Aspirations, they often say to me, I'll ask them, do you feel like you're in this conversation or you're in this group and everybody seems to get what's going on? Everybody seems to get this inside joke, but you're sort of somehow left out. And often they say to me, yes, that's exactly what happens. I just feel like I'm out there somewheres and I'm clueless.
So do people with ASD still feel emotions deeply?
Absolutely. They sometimes feel emotions in a different way. And sometimes it's not apparent. And it's very easy to say, oh, they don't have emotions or they're a robot or they lack total empathy or sympathy. But I have a lot of testimony. I give the example of 3 years ago, I had heart surgery. And the letters that I got and the emails that I got expressing a tremendous amount of worry about—
From your folks
from
and
my
aspirations.
Folks in the program mm-hmm. were amazing. They were heartfelt. They were sincere. They were talking to other people in the group. They were copied to me. They just have that sometimes— The way they express it or the way that they analyze things comes across to people as that they lack empathy, that they can't relate to things. Sometimes it takes them longer to process it, or sometimes they process it in a different way.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This hour, we're talking about the social issues regarding autism, people who have been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. We're going to hear about how performing arts have been adapted for people who have been diagnosed with ASD. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Joining me in the studio right now is Jeff Siegel. He's the coordinator of the OSU program Aspirations. It was established to give social and vocational support for people with autism at OSU. I was trying to think about how you manage a group of people diagnosed with ASD because it's kind of like a one-room schoolhouse. Every single kid in the room every single person is coming at you with something different.
Mm-hmm. So I think it is important to really understand that if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism.
Right.
There is too often we try to give this sort of broad, you know, broad-brushed diagnosis. Oh, well, you have autism, so you might bang your head, or you can't, you have no empathy, or you have, each one is different. For one individual might be very reserved in a interview with you, and yet the other person, will give you more information than you really totally need. A great example of that is I had one girl who I interviewed for my program, and I asked her, do you have siblings? The simple response would be yes or no, or tell me their names. She gave me a list of, and she had four siblings, I think, of everything that was wrong and what they were in trouble with, and the mother was totally humiliated. And she says, well,
wearing
Mom,
the dirty linen.
What do you want? You know, that's just the way things are. Nothing to be ashamed of. And I had to point out to her, actually, if you think about it, I really asked you, do you have brothers or sisters? And a simple answer is yes or no. So I try to deal with them all. When we're in the group, I deal with them individually, knowing their characteristics. I try to know who they are personally and try to adapt that to what we're trying to discuss. But I address them when they address me. I try to address them based upon what I know about them and how they respond best. So I really put a lot of time into getting to know who they are individually, because I really truly believe each one has a definitive personality that makes them up.
What are the benefits of bringing them all together in the same place?
I think that it's important for them to learn to find that there are other people that are going through the same things that they are, that have the same struggles. Some of them are struggling more than they are so that they can offer something. Others have succeeded where they're struggling and they can see an example. Those people look at the others and say, wow, I've helped this individual out. I can be of benefit. It's not just me getting something and I need to work on my skills. You know, I can really help somebody else. So each person begins to feel that they're not alone, and they find things that they have in common with each other.
Tell us about the Aspirations group, what you do, how it operates.
The way the group works is we have different subjects that we talk about. For example, we start off with introductions the first session and really getting to know each other, talking about how to start a simple conversation, just to become comfortable with that. And a lot of
them. Do you group them by age?
So we have basically two different groups. I have a teen group, which is basically 13 to 18. And then I have my adult group, which is 18 and up. Most people in the adult group are 18 to say 30. But occasionally there are people who approach me who are in their 30s. And I've even had one or two that are in their 40s who seem like they're in the same difficulty and seem at the same social and maturity as the 20-year-olds. And so my feeling is if they will fit within the group, then they may as well be included.
But they might necessarily have been diagnosed, is what you're saying? Or
for the most part, they've been diagnosed, but there are some that come to me that are in the process. They're looking into a diagnosis, or others that are struggling with the same issues that an individual who has an official diagnosis on the spectrum. And my attitude is if they can fit within the group and they seem comfortable and they can benefit from what we're doing, then I feel the more the merrier.
Autism usually is diagnosed pretty young in childhood now, but your groups are for teens and young adults. Why did you focus on that population? Could the same sort of approach be of benefit to younger kids?
It probably could. When I came into the program in 2006, it had already been established as an adult program, basically 18 to 25. As I started to go along in the program, in a few years, I kept getting inquiries about teens. Just basically, based on the resources that we have, I don't feel at this time that we have the ability to really serve anybody beyond, you know, below the age, say, of 13. And I think that there are a lot of there are other programs in the community that do serve that age.
What is going on with the diagnosis, the numbers? It's 1 out of 68, they're saying now. That's up from 1 out of 80-something just a year or so ago. It's really pretty dramatic, the numbers change with this.
That is something that I can't address directly. I don't.
What's your sense about it, though?
I do believe that a lot of people are becoming more aware of individuals on the spectrum.
Meaning they're bringing their kids in for diagnosis.
They're bringing
or
their kids
evaluation.
In for diagnosis, or realizing that this is at a younger age that there are issues that are there that are not being negated anymore, that are not sort of being poo-pooed and said, oh, you know, just give them a chance to grow up. They're fine. You're worrying too much, mom. Because it's often the mother that, not always, but often the mother that does see something that doesn't seem right. And everybody in the family is saying, you're overreacting. You need just to give that kid a good smack across the face, or just they're too lazy. You know, they're just often this is what I hear from a lot of people. A lot of parents do struggle with other family members in terms of getting an understanding of what they're going through on a daily basis.
You said that you interview them before they join the group. Is that to give them access to the group? I mean, are you screening?
I do screen them. I want to make sure that, number one, that because the group is focused on individuals generally at a higher level of functionability, I want to make sure that they're at that functionability. But also, I want to make sure that they have the right attitude. If they, say, would fit at a functional level in the group, but they're opposed and their parents are sort of pushing them to do this, in the end, it really isn't going to benefit them or benefit the group. If they're just in there for some benefit, for some bribe that their parents give them, or because somebody coerced them, it doesn't benefit either one of us. So that's why it's important to me to find individuals who I think have the potential to really benefit from the program.
The program also gives vocational support for people with autism. How is vocational training important, or how does that manifest in the group?
So what we focus on with vocational training is the real basics. Before you get to what job do you want, how do you interview for a job? What are some things you say? For instance, if somebody asks you, if an employer asks you, do you have reliable transportation? The employer doesn't want to hear anything but yes.
Right.
End of discussion.
They don't want to hear about
They don't want to hear about
car.
Your car. They don't want to hear about that you could take the number 2 bus and that it could be 10 minutes late, but if you didn't take that bus, you could take the 4 bus, but it's 5 blocks away. They don't want to hear that. They also don't want to hear that you don't have reliable transportation. So you better know that you have reliable transportation, or how you're going to figure that out if you get the job. And that's something that I emphasize to them. You want to do a job. Don't say to yourself, if you're somebody who can't get up in the morning, don't say, well, I can take a job at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'll make it work, and not know how you're going to make it work, because it probably won't work if you can't get to the job because you're still asleep. These are things that we talk about. Be prepared for that. If you're somebody who has sensory issues with tremendous noise, don't take a job in a factory. It may be too much. Can you deal with that? Know that. So I have I have different charts that I use to get them to seriously think about where I might fit best in terms of a job.
For people who higher functioning people with autism spectrum disorder, do they have a maturity arc? Is there a growth to their maturity so that when you're getting on that 13 to 18 year old age? And trying to talk about these issues with them, they're more self-aware. And
I do see a change in individuals. And again, there are some individuals who do make changes quicker and some who take a much longer time. That's why they're so individual. I have had people call me 6 months or 4 months after they finish the program and tell me their daughter suddenly is talking to everybody at work and she never did this before. Asking them how they are. In the past, they would just say hi, and she would say hi, and that was basically it. It wasn't that she didn't have the ability. She just didn't feel socially comfortable talking to people. Others, it's sometimes a few years later I get a call. And
Something clicks.
So I emphasize with families in the group, in the program, you know, don't, if you're sitting there and looking for this huge change, you're going to miss the little changes.
My guest is Jeff Siegel. He's the coordinator of Aspirations. That's a group established at Ohio State to give social and vocational support for people with autism. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking today about autism. It's a developmental disorder that affects communication and social skills. The Centers for Disease Control now estimates that 1 in 68 people has been identified with autism. For people with autism, normal everyday pleasures like having a conversation or joking around with friends can cause anxiety and a sense of isolation. Still with us is Jeff Siegel. He's coordinator of the Aspirations Autism Program at the Neisonger Center at OSU. Joining us now is an alumnus of the program, 18-year-old Scott Valick. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Thank you.
Also with us is Scott's mother, Carolyn Valick. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
If anybody out there has a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So, Scott, you joined the Aspirations Teen Program. What did you do in there?
Well, every day we would have a different kind of conversation about maybe it would be on your siblings or at school and kind of what we had troubles with in like conversations or everyday life.
What conversation sticks with you? What do you remember most?
The one I remember most is kind of facial expressions, kind of seeing what we should look for if the person's kind of, I don't want to talk now, or they're like, why are you still talking? Or they just want to not be talked to as much.
Uh-huh. And what do you remember about that? What did you learn about how to behave differently?
I kind of figured out why some of my friends might get annoyed when I'm talking too much, or they kind of were not as outcoming as what I thought they were.
Mm-hmm. Did you like Aspirations? Jeff Siegel, before I go on, Jeff Siegel said earlier that, you know, he interviews people first to make sure there's enough buy-in, that the participants want to be there and they're ready to do some work.
I did see that a lot of them were really wanting to stay connected and were ready for this.
Did you want to do it at first?
Not entirely, because I was just recently diagnosed with it, and I'm like, I don't see it, but a lot of my teachers and my parents said, you should at least try it, and I'm glad I did.
Did you see it when you tried it?
Yeah, I saw it a lot more.
Because you're around other people more like you?
Yes.
Did you like that?
It was nice to know that I'm not entirely alone and going through this without help.
Jeff?
I think that sometimes what happens when individuals come to Aspirations, they have in mind therapy programs that they've gone to in the past, where they are individually going into these talking groups and learning about how they feel, and they're working on specific skills. But it's, the difference with Aspirations is that we really focus on a total unit, on the family unit. I have parents coming to that have their own session simultaneously. We have a sibling session as well, and then we have activities that follow up after the eight-week program. And sometimes some of the individuals come thinking that when we talk about a program that works with individuals on the spectrum, that we're probably working with individuals that are much lower in functioning than they are. And they're surprised to find out that they're talking to people who are very much like them.
Carolyn Valick, Scott was diagnosed his senior year in high school.
Yes.
What brought you to that point?
How did we get there?
Yeah.
Well, the speech pathologist at the high school thought that Scott might have be on the spectrum, and I was very surprised because I really did not see it, because I thought it was a matter of, you know, some of the learning disabilities and ADHD that Scott had been working through, which I've now understand is very common with parents, that they think that is what the challenge is. Mm-hmm. And he was also diagnosed with a genetic disease that my husband has, and there is a correlation with autism and that disease. So it was very tough for me to kind of walk the walk, and Aspirations really made it helpful because having the parent support group there, other parents were also still trying to get their arms around the autism diagnosis, and it really helped to, you know, walk the walk with the other parents and get on board with, yes, Scott does have this diagnosis.
And share stories and finally have someone who knows what you're talking about.
Yes,
yeah.
And to realize that, okay, he is on the spectrum.
Jeff Siegel, so there's a parent support group too.
Yes, parent support group meets simultaneously because it really sends a strong message to the individual on the spectrum that their parents are not just dropping them off and saying, okay, now go to this program and enjoy it and get something out of it. We're going to go off and go shopping in the mall. We're working at the same time. We're coming and we're going to a session at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents choose the topics. So there's a list of topics. So some people were interested in how do I teach my child how to drive? Well, it turned out that Scott knew how to drive. So as a parent, I was helpful to other parents when I said, okay, here's the approach that we took and here are the expectations that we had. It was very helpful to other parents to hear that.
Right.
And it was also helpful for me to hear topics like other communication, other resources in the community that I did not know about.
614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Nawanda in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Nawanda.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You're going to have to turn off your television or your radio.
Okay. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I'm just calling because I'm new to the area, and my son needs quite a bit of help. We're new to this and not sure, you know, we have some resources, but there are other resources out there we're not sure of, like being an advocate for him. I'm trying to do that. And some other things, some other issues that we're having is his diaper prescription. He was supposed to get that refilled. They've been slow at doing that. Mm-hmm. I'm just having a
Yeah. Well, you're in Cincinnati, and we're in Columbus, so I don't know what we can do for you on that level, but Jeff Siegel, some suggestions about where they should get started?
Well, if you want, you can call me at my office, 685-3188, and I'll be happy to refer you to some resources in Cincinnati. Or we have on our website, nisonger.osu.edu, we have a number of different resources and links. So, but to start, if you want to call me, I'll be happy to put you in touch with somebody there.
Okay, Nawanda. We'll post that information on our website at wosu.org/allsides if you didn't catch that. Good luck, Nawanda. Is there that feeling, Carol and Valak, that there's just, you don't know where to start? That
yes.
Everyone thinks, well, one out of 68 now, there must be a ton of resources out there. It must be painfully obvious, but it apparently isn't.
It's overwhelming.
Okay.
And this, where the parent support group is very helpful because every week an expert from OSU or from the community comes to talk to the parents on a particular topic.
There's always something.
Yeah, to help ease the way and to take one topic at a time.
So one suggestion for Nawanda then would be find a parent support group.
Yes.
ASAP.
Yes.
All right.
That's a good idea.
Scott Valak, you're now in a young adult group with Aspirations, right? You're in a different group?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us about that and what's different and what's the same.
Well, I was diagnosed by Dr. Amigo in Amigo Family Counseling, and he said he has a support group kind of called 50 Days, and that kind of is a group of people that have autism. And we talk about different things, like we talk about how to deal with people in the workspace, and kind of we learn more about what autism is and how it can affect people.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of helps us see how we can still be in the real world and interact with people.
What are your expectations? Are you going to go to college? What are your plans?
I'm going to go to college and try to find a job. And
mm-hmm. What are you interested in?
I'm interested in recreations, but more of like the activities, planning of those mm-hmm. areas. And I was going to go into the therapy side, but I found another degree kind of close to that, which mm-hmm. I found was more what I wanted to do.
One thing that's wonderful, if I could jump in, Scott, is that Scott is in an autism college transition program through Columbus State, so he will actually have a little more support than he ordinarily would if he just went to any college. So mm-hmm. it's going to be a great start to help him transition to a regular university.
I suppose in some ways, Jeff Siegel, you've seen a sea change in what's available to folks out there.
There's been a big change. There's so much more out there. There's so much more literature. And I've really only been involved, as I say, with working with this population and working with autism on a professional basis since 2006 when I did an internship at the Niazonger Center. And it's really, it's refreshing and it seems to be growing. There are more support groups out there. Which I think is really important. It's important for these individuals to connect with online support groups. People, organizations run by individuals on the spectrum is really important rather than necessarily just the professional organizations out there.
Mm-hmm. Scott Valick, you got interested in theater in elementary school, and we're going to be talking about a production of The Tempest that's been adapted especially for people on the autism spectrum. We'll be talking about that in our next segment, but there is something about theater that resonated with you and worked for you. Tell us about that.
Well, when I was about, I think, 6 or 7, we did work, we volunteered at the Children's Theater in Columbus, and I was just an usher, and I would watch the plays they did, and I don't know why, I just fell in love with it. So when I finally got older, I started doing plays. And I guess one of the things that helped me is it gave me confidence to be in front of a group of people that are just watching me and I could just be what I wanted to do. And it just was amazing to feel that thing. And it kind of let me escape from the world and to see who I am. Well, who I am to the rest of the world. And even though I'm playing someone else, I'm still has a part of me in it. And mm-hmm. I don't have to worry about being surprised by a curveball or something because I know what is happening and what is going on.
Carolyn Valick, what you encouraged him to get involved in theater. Did you have an idea that this might trigger, you know, that level of comfort for him? Or what were
yes,
you thinking?
We
what were you thinking?
We could see it immediately.
Yeah.
He was very comfortable.
But this is long before he was diagnosed.
Yes. It, you know, you're dealing with your child no matter what. Even without a label, you know what you're looking for, the right fit, for the right niche for your child. Mm-hmm. And so it was immediately apparent that he loved the theater. But I think what really helped is he knew what the other person was going to say in retrospect as I look back. And Scott, I think you would agree, right?
Yes.
That he knew what the lines were. And they also studied the lines. And when, by the time he got to high school under Bronwyn Hopton, when you know she'd been there for years, they would study the lines and she would teach them what the humor is. If it was a British play, she would teach them what the humor is.
Because that would be something not everybody
that he wouldn't necessarily get.
And neither would a lot of the other people.
Right.
Right.
But because she was teaching them, this is what this means and this is how they, Scott was able to be himself more expressive than he had ever been in his life. So, Scott, do you remember when you were Lane, the butler, and the importance of being earnest?
I remember that production
at
Thomas Worthington.
Yes, Scott was the butler. And do you remember enjoying that?
Yes, she would go through the accents, and she would basically take us to this huge auditorium. And she's like, just yell the lines. In theater, you can never be too loud. And I was like, oh, my gosh. So.
Yay.
Yeah.
And so he was never so expressive as he was. So I would watch every one of his performances, no matter how small the part.
Uh-huh.
Mrs. Hopton had a way of, you know, every part. No, there is no small part for any actor.
Uh-huh.
And I just saw Scott being so expressive and comfortable knowing that he was hitting the note the way he should because the director had showed him that.
Did being in theater and learning how to act help you? Because actually, when we all think about it, we're all acting. We're all on a stage. And we're all acting to a certain degree. Did that help?
It did, because with different parts, we would see kind of how we have to say it so that it comes across as what the person's trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
One part that she was kind of like coaching me for was Felix and the Odd Couple.
Okay.
Which I did not get, but it was fine. But she would kind of tell me how to say it because I'm sounding like a basket case. in the part she was trying to get me to do. And she said you have to enunciate, be loud, express yourself when you're talking about her cooking and her cleaning. And I just was so amazed that I could do it. And I kind of found that when I am kind of over-emotional, it's hard for people to understand what I'm saying because I'm going so fast.
Uh-huh.
And it was helpful to see that I now know how to react calmly but still can show that I'm still sad or overexcited or any emotion.
So he had a chance to practice all these emotions while not being actually in the real life.
Right.
So that's what I think has really been helpful for you.
And if I can add,
sure,
the great thing about theatrics is that many situations, you have to make sudden decisions, split decisions, or act a certain way and change. And one of the biggest struggles for individuals on the spectrum is the change in routine. It really teaches you almost how to learn to act as if. So while you may have an issue with the routine, but you can learn to adapt to certain things a little easier through the drama and through the dramatics of the play and what you're doing.
We're going to be talking about the production of The Tempest that has been adapted, especially for people with autism. I wanted to ask you, Scott, you started out as an usher in a theater, as a volunteer. Being in theater and being a part of the audience, has that ever been a struggle for you?
Not for me, mm-hmm. really. I always thought it was interesting to see how people would take the play and make it kind of either for a higher age group or a younger age group.
Uh-huh.
And I always thought it was amazing. I never really had trouble sitting for a long period of time without being able to talk or really do anything but watch the play and listen.
So.
And I don't really know what it's like for other people because every case is different.
Right. Exactly. Every case is different.
Scott, the theater is quiet. So you know, when you look at the spectrum, the theater is a quiet place. People are listening just to the stage. So mm-hmm. for him, it was the perfect fit for where he is on the spectrum.
Well, thank you, Scott Valek, so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you.
Yep. And also to you for joining us as well. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Jeff Siegel, you'll stay with us for a little while?
Sure.
All right. That was Scott Valek. And sorry, I'm losing my voice again. And his mother,
Carolyn
Valek. If you have a question or comment, you want to join us, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Theater buffs might recognize that clip as a tense moment from Shakespeare's play, The Tempest. But audience members have probably never seen a production adapted quite like this one, where audience members participate with actors playing sensory games to understand the many facets of the play. This production, which will be in Columbus this week, is adapted especially for people with autism. Joining us now from New York to tell us more is the director of the special version of The Tempest, actress Kelly Hunter. Welcome to the show, Kelly.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also joining us in the studio is director of the Shakespeare and Autism Program at Ohio State University, Robin Post. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you for having me.
And still with us, Jess Siegel. He's coordinator of Aspirations. That's a group established to give social and vocational support for people with autism at Ohio State University. Jeff? Oh, okay.
Hello.
Oh, Shakespeare does not seem like an obvious route to take for kids with autism. The language is difficult. The plots could be complex for a lot of people. You don't have to be a kid to be struggle with them sometime. What's the connection here, Kelly Hunter?
So, the games that that we play in this show are taken from moments in Shakespeare, where Shakespeare is really describing how it feels to be alive. And children with autism find it very difficult to express their feelings. So the work is a distillation of what Shakespeare is exploring, which encompasses the idea of making eye contact and expressing the feelings, how close or far away from somebody you can or cannot be, generally the experience of being alive. So we don't do the whole play, although we do cover the story of the play, but we don't have to speak all the words.
Mm-hmm. And Robin Post, tell us about the Shakespeare and Autism Program and how, you know, why Shakespeare?
That's probably a better question for Kelly. But the Shakespeare and Autism Project started in 2011 when Kelly arrived here.
Okay.
And it's a research project. So it's a longitudinal 3-year-long research project. We've worked with 54 children total and 4 public schools, one of them private. They have done workshops for 42 weeks total, once a week, and 5 core actors met with those children once a week for that period of time. There were children immersed in the intervention, and then there was a waitlisted group of children. So there is a research project attached to this, and we're waiting to find the results. We have some preliminary results that are really promising.
What are you studying?
We're looking to see whether or not Kelly's work, the Hunter Heartbeat Method, can affect the core features of autism, can affect change to the core features of autism.
Kelly, Hunter, tell us about the Hunter Heartbeat Method.
Sure. I mean, I'll go back one step to why Shakespeare.
Okay.
As I said before, Shakespeare explores what it feels like to be alive. And these drama games, which it's really important to say, are really fun to play. They are enjoyable, they're short, they're repetitive. The children get the chance to explore their feelings, explore all the different sensory areas of their life, from seeing to hearing to touching, tasting. And these short games are right at the heart of what Shakespeare was writing about. What does it feel like to see and to fall in love and to feel anger, for instance? So no other playwright quite nails those feelings in the way he does. And the rhythm of the language, which is where the Hunter Heartbeat Method, the title of that comes from, is written in the rhythm of a heartbeat. The iambic pentameter is the rhythm of a heartbeat, and arguably it's the first sound we hear in the womb before we're born. So we sit in a circle to begin the play when the children come, and they have this calming experience of making the sound of a heartbeat, beating it out on the rhythm of it with their hands on their chests, with the actors. And it turns out it really presents a calming experience for them. And once that has happened, the children are in a more receptive state and they can start to play. And no other playwright has the combination of how it feels to be alive plus the rhythm of the language.
And what age groups are you talking about with children? Mm.
So this show works for children from 8 years old upwards to 24, and in fact it'll work with any adult with autism who would like to come and experience the show. We've had many young adults come when we did it in Stratford-upon-Avon a few weeks ago. So 8+, and then the world is, there's no limit.
And give us an example of some of the games you play using that method. Mm.
Sure. So for instance, a humorous and very enjoyable game is where the two lovers in The Tempest, Miranda and Ferdinand, first see each other. Miranda's father says at the first sight they have changed eyes. So we play a kind of game's eyes on stalks, cartoon game where their eyes go doing, which is very good fun to do.
Uh-huh.
And the children get the chance to do that with the actors and with each other. And you know, if you did that, if you just said to a child in a therapist room, "Look at my eyes," they probably wouldn't. But in the moment of playing and in the guise of role play and with the actors, the children find that they will make eye contact. So it's they're able to break through their autism and at the same time have an enormous amount of fun.
Does this approach with theater, as therapy that way, does it affect the size of the audience? How many how many people can be in an audience?
Yeah, that's really key. It's a tiny audience. It's 15 at the most.
Okay.
And this is I really enjoy that. This show is people friendly. There are 6 actors, 15 children. They sit on the floor all together in a circle around a floor cloth, which represents the island. Huh. And the actors meet the children, and they give them enough time that they need to settle down, or the young adults as well. And then when they're ready, we start making heartbeats, and I offer a little warm-up session beforehand, making the heartbeats and starting to play with faces, recognizing faces. And then the show very gently starts to emerge from there. And around the outer circle, there are a number of chairs for parents and teachers and interested audience members to sit and observe the show.
And that's 30. I just wanted to make sure that that was clear.
Oh,
so that the number of children joining us is 15 maximum, and then the people watching outside circle is 30.
Jeff Siegel, I was watching you sort of nod when you were listening to Kelly describe, you know, what they do. What makes sense to you out of all this?
When Kelly was talking about if a therapist asked you to look in their eyes, they would probably do anything but. They would look at the ceiling. They would look at the floor. They'd look inside. They'd have a lot of difficulty often looking directly at you. However, if you get them in some sort of role play, like, for instance, when we talk about friendship, I make them all, much to their dismay, especially the adults, I have them sing "You've Got a Friend in Me" from Toy Story. And they all groan and moan, "Oh, no, not, you know, you're not going to make me do this." But they get, after, even the ones that are most resistant, as soon as they get into it, they're looking, they're comfortable. The ones that were really tight and, you know, really anxious have relaxed, and they're all getting into it. And they all especially laugh when I try to do the musical parts. So that's what really I connected with.
Kelly, it's interesting to talk about Shakespeare as therapy in this way, because they're also getting exposed to this incredible theater and these incredible messages that come through Shakespeare. Do you sense that they get do we know what they get out of it intellectually?
Yes. Yes, a huge amount. I mean, Shakespeare stimulates the mind intellectually, but at the same time, it stimulates the feelings. So it's the connection between the feeling and thought that Shakespeare really hones into. So a young man who came to the show, for instance, when we were doing it in Stratford a few weeks ago, there's during another game we play where Ariel puts Ferdinand under a trance, a very, very simple drama game where Ferdinand has to stare into the palm of Ariel's hand, and there's a little bit of music, and he's led around the stage, and the children get the chance to play that. This young man started speaking right from his soul about where he came from, how he was an exploded star that seemed to vanish in the universe. And he really didn't know, it seemed that, well, he had no bounds. He was unleashed. His feelings were just completely able to come out, and he connected at such a deep level with Shakespeare. It was quite remarkable. And our show allows that kind of thing to happen. There is no good or bad behavior from an audience. The audience are allowed to express whatever it is that they're feeling through playing these games. And it's very surprising as well, in that we're not trying to get them to think a certain way. We're just trying to unlock whatever it is that they're thinking.
If you have a question or comment out there, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Wexner Center for the Arts and WOSU COSI present Shakespeare's The Tempest, adapted for audiences with autism. That's this week. See the link on our page for more information at wosu.org/allsides. Robin, you've led OSU Shakespeare and Autism Workshops. Who are your participants? Who are the actors and the teachers, and what is their experience?
Yeah, so the students that comprise the acting team are undergraduates, graduate students, and faculty. And they are, I think we've introduced Kelly's work to 20 students so far. And they are predominantly students in the theater department, graduate students, undergraduate students, and some faculty from the theater department. But we have also met and included students interested in this work from different aspects, so psychology departments, majoring in psychology, majoring in social work, majoring in human development, things of that nature. And their experience with this has been incredible, as has mine, quite frankly. I was just listening to Kelly talk about that child and got overwhelmed.
Yeah.
So the experience that these students are having and that I'm having with the students has just been incredible. I think life-changing for them. Lots of these students are going on and deciding that this is a career they want to pursue as a result of this work in one fashion or another, whether it's through theater or they just want to go on and study behavior therapy and things of this nature. It's hard to explain at this point. The more that we work on this project, and now it's evolved into this amazing production, and working with these children is quite profound, and it becomes more and more difficult to explain in a sense, because the trust that comes into the space is pretty immediate and from all of us. So what it takes to play like that for anyone is quite a great deal of trust, and for these children to come in the moment and join us in that is pretty remarkable.
You were there then when, or were you just?
I'm actually an actor in the production as well. So
you heard the child describe feeling like an exploding star.
Yes, it was unbelievable.
What happens to the troupe? What happens to the moment when something like that does happen? How do you pause? Do you go on?
I imagine everyone has a different experience to that. I mean, we don't stop the show, as it were. We just keep moving along. I think everyone takes in these moments in their own way. Mm-hmm. And we go on with the show, and I think most of us process all of this information after the fact and how incredible it was. But you don't want to sort of interrupt the moment, certainly. So
May I come in?
Yes, absolutely, Kelly.
I think as I said before, what I'm so happy with in the production, and what I always wanted to make, which we have, is, as I said, a show where the audience can really express what they're feeling at the very time that Shakespeare is touching them. So when I first wanted to do this work, it was really to invigorate people's souls with Shakespeare at the very moment that they encountered Shakespeare, not so that they could be educated or that they would want to go to the theatre later on in their lives, but that something woke them up. So this work at its best wakes up the people who are encountering it. And in this case, it's children with autism who are experiencing an awakening. And I really would like to emphasize as well that the fun that is also had, it is not... although it is a very profound and serious endeavor, it's really good fun. And the feedback we've had from the parents and the teachers is that they've never seen their children play in this way and engage and laugh and really find what it is in childhood that maybe a lot of children with autism miss out on, which is to be able to play, which is everyone's right as a child and, in fact, as an adult.
Kelly, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you, what appealed to you about The Tempest in terms of this kind of a production?
Yeah.
Are there others?
I've done this work with a few of Shakespeare's other plays, Midsummer Night's Dream notably. But this one also at the center of it has the character of Caliban and also Ariel, who are imprisoned at the beginning of the play and are seeking their liberty. And the children with autism really seem to lock into that. They understand unconsciously what it's like to not to be free and to be fighting against something inside them. So that's really the key for this production as well. And there's this wonderful joy and release when the two characters at the end are given their freedom.
Wexner Center for the Arts and WOSU COSI present Shakespeare's The Tempest. It's been adapted for audiences with autism. It's this week. Check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information. Kelly Hunter is the director of this adapted version of The Tempest. Kelly Hunter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Robin Post, she's the director of the Shakespeare and Autism Program at Ohio State University. Robin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Jeff Siegel, coordinator of OSU's Aspirations, established to give social and vocational support for people with autism. Jeff, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.